Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, brought to you by the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Cleo, and with me are my co-hosts, Aubrey and Daniela.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys. As always, be sure to follow along with us on Twitter. You can find us by the name at ISGPForum or by searching the hashtag ISGPForum.
And definitely check us out on Facebook as well, where we direct you to all kinds of articles and information relevant to our podcast topics. You'll find us there by searching ISGP's The Forum.
Thanks for all the social media shout-outs, guys. Now I think it's time to dive into today's episode. Although, I guess before we do that, I should give a little disclaimer that the topic is a little abstract, or at least more so than, say, sea level rise or genetic modification. Today we're talking about syndromic surveillance, and don't worry, we'll get into that definition soon.
Yeah, this episode topic definitely is a little more conceptual and non-concrete than others. But essentially, we'll be discussing whether or not current disease and outbreak surveillance is adequate, necessary, or potentially even a waste of money in today's world.
So basically, what is right and wrong with what we're doing to detect and prevent disease? And are there better alternatives to our current actions?
Exactly. To begin, let's go over the paper that inspired the debate that inspired the podcast.
Lots of inspiration today.
Yes, well, that is the idea. So Dr. Arthur Reingold presented his paper, Novel Surveillance Systems, Good Value for Money Spent, at the conference Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases, Focus on Surveillance, in Warrenton, Virginia, from October 17 through 20, 2010.
Dr. Reingold currently is a professor at the Division of Epidemiology and the Associate Dean of Research at the School of Public Health at the University of California at Berkeley.
First, let's start with that definition of syndromic surveillance, shall we? Since this discussion basically revolves around it. Dr. Reingold defines it as surveillance for clinical syndromes without or before a definitive diagnosis can or is made.
Okay, I know that definitions usually clear things up, but I'm somehow more confused than I was before. What exactly does that mean again?
You're not alone, Aubrey. This is actually bringing us to our first point of discussion among the debaters. Turns out that this definition isn't in fact very helpful or definitive at all, and that's a problem. To break it down a little further, both the debaters and author describe it as a novel methods of disease surveillance that typically involve monitoring the frequency of one or more illnesses with a specified set of clinical features. Okay, now I'm a little lost, actually.
What I think we're trying to get at here, besides the fact that a working definition of syndromic surveillance is highly needed, is that this is a form of surveillance without any actual lab testing, which instead relies on paying closer attention to things like environmental indicators.
Oh, okay, so things like looking at newspaper reports and web search queries? I think I'm getting a better idea of this now.
I think we can work with that for now. So, what's all the fuss over this form of disease surveillance anyway?
Well, Dr. Reingold very clearly states that these syndromic surveillance systems are very much in place and operating. Some institutions even having entire research programs centered on this idea, but the concrete benefits of the practice actually remain unproven.
Because of this, there's a huge need for an evaluation of this surveillance and its benefits to public health and national security.
Wait, so if this hasn't been evaluated, how did it get implemented so quickly and thoroughly?
Well, the method actually works in certain statistical parameters, meaning that, in theory, the method works for a certain set of scenarios. The issue is that the practical utility of syndromic surveillance is still sort of up in the air. An example of when this surveillance method didn't work is the 2001 case of Bacillus anthracis spores in the U.S., otherwise known as that time you were scared to open your mailbox for fear of finding anthrax.
Which reminds me of that NCIS episode in which Tony DiNoso gets bubonic plague. Ugh, Michael Weatherly, why did you have to leave that show?
We can debate the merits of that decision off air. But according to Dr. Reingold, it seems that syndromic surveillance is unlikely to detect important outbreaks that would have otherwise gone undetected. Currently, all or virtually all outbreaks of any significance are detected through existing disease-specific surveillance systems and or via reporting by astute clinicians or laboratories.
And when it does detect something early, there's not much confidence that it'll be early enough to have significant value.
Isn't earlier detection always better, though?
It's counterintuitive, but not necessarily. Dr. Reingold thinks that this amount of early detection will rarely lead to reduced morbidity or mortality. And on top of that, the majority of the work to actually analyze this collected data falls on top of already overworked public health officials.
Okay, so it may just be adding more stress to the system. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay, so now that we have an idea of what the paper presented at this debate had to say, let's start getting into what the debaters themselves thought on the subject.
Good idea. Like Dr. Reingold, the debaters also questioned whether this is an adequate return for the financial and human investments allocated to syndromic surveillance.
The debaters also didn't seem supportive of the idea that syndromic surveillance was a predictor of any instances of bioterrorism in recent U.S. history.
Things aren't looking so good for this method of surveillance, huh?
Yeah, apparently not. I think that's why debaters really pushed to have U.S. federal government reevaluate the role of syndromic surveillance, and possibly even redirect its funding. This greater allocation of funding would most likely have major effects on the role and support of this form of surveillance worldwide.
Wait, though. Let's not get down to syndromic surveillance too soon now. There are, in fact, instances where it can be and even was very useful.
Okay, true. In the case of smallpox, syndromic data did, in fact, provide a clinical definition for the disease during the eradication effort.
And not just any definition, but one that replaced laboratory confirmation as the only method of case identification.
So basically, instead of waiting around for lab results to come back and confirm your smallpox case, healthcare providers could simply use this definition to deduce whether or not you were infected and then should be treated.
Not that I've ever had smallpox or anything, but I feel like I'd be much happier as a patient with earlier and quicker detection of that disease, especially if it doesn't involve needles for lab testing.
Can't argue with you there.
It doesn't stop there, though. Syndromic surveillance also played a key role in severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, detection. Initial detection of this outbreak involved data on the symptoms of the patients, which is a syndromic method, and this helped facilitate global recognition of the disease at its earliest stages.
It also played a role in polio detection, as syndromic surveillance for acute flaccid paralysis, the rapid onset of muscle weakness, was recognized as an effective method of identification for the disease.
So it seems like this method does actually have some redeeming qualities, especially in the context of surveillance for certain diseases with well-defined intervention programs. It was noted, however, that this seems to be beneficial only on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, so surveillance of malaria through detection of a fever, for instance, hasn't produced accurate or reliable information on its spread.
Okay, but getting back to the subject of how it actually may be useful, wouldn't syndromic surveillance be useful in less wealthy nations? Because if it doesn't require labs, which many countries don't have an abundance of, then it could maybe really help out some of these more remote or poor areas. Or am I just totally off on that assumption?
You're definitely on the right track there, Daniela. The debaters actually brought up this idea. While the U.S. is quite well off in the laboratory department, resources to conduct infectious disease surveillance through lab confirmations are simply not available or extremely scarce in some regions.
And in these instances of scarcity, syndromic surveillance can step in and save the day, or save lives actually, by establishing baselines against which the presence of disease outbreaks can be measured.
This isn't quite a cure-all. Well, it's not a cure at all, actually. But it certainly can provide a way to fill in the gaps until adequate laboratory and epidemiological capacity can be established.
Syndromic surveillance. Not perfect. Only works in some scenarios, but better than nothing.
I don't know if we quite want to sum it up so frankly, Cleo. Maybe we can say something like, because of syndromic surveillance's varying uses, the benefit of this method is case-dependent. There are times the public health benefits match the costs, but when thorough laboratory-based surveillance methods are available, syndromic surveillance might not be worth it.
I sort of like mine better, much more snappy and catchy. But I guess what you said is correct, at least.
We keep specifying whether or not the surveillance is worth the cost, but what kind of cost are we talking about here exactly?
It's interesting you bring that up, because we're actually not 100% sure on this either. There was some agreement among the debaters that the number is somewhere in the millions of dollars, but we don't have any specific or confirmed number here.
And there's certainly a big difference between $5 and $50 million. This is where you, as our listeners, can actually chime in and help us out. Do you have a better idea of what the actual cost of performing and maintaining syndromic surveillance is? Tweet it to us at ISGP Forum.
Okay, and something else we sort of need help on is this tricky definition, actually. After extensive conversation from the debaters, they still couldn't exactly pin down something concrete.
And while this may seem like a trivial aspect of the syndromic surveillance conversation, the absence of a working definition can really be a barrier to determining how effective it is and what its role can be among surveillance systems in general.
Without a firm agreement on a definition, it's hard to avoid confusion and misunderstandings about syndromic surveillance's efficacy and its value in disease surveillance.
Definitely. And in this day and age, with information technology and scientific capabilities progressing so rapidly, there is now so much data covering such a wide range of information that could, in theory, be considered syndromic surveillance.
And now we just have to be sure that we know how to accurately analyze this increasingly diverse pool of information in ways that make it valuable to someone who may be making surveillance decisions.
More and more information can, of course, enhance understanding, but it also has a tendency to complicate and challenge analysis. It's sort of like having to catch one real snitch, but there also happen to be about 50 more fake snitches buzzing around your Quidditch field just to lead you astray. Or in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, when Harry had to fly around and find that one key to unlock the door in the tunnel amongst all the other decoy keys. It was super easy because the real one was big and rusty with damaged wings, but...
Whoa, calm down, soldier. I didn't know you were such a Harry Potter book freak.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I've never actually read the books. I've just seen each movie approximately 24 times.
Are you serious? How dare you even comment on the story if you've never even read the books? I can't believe.
Whoa, guys, calm down. I personally have never even watched the movies or read the books, so you can direct all your anger towards me. Anyway, I'm sure I'm not the only one, so regardless of the amount of snitches or information we have flying around, what's important is whether or not this can be turned into an effective preventive action, in the case of diseases, of course.
While earlier notification of an outbreak can give more time for scientists to have targeted vaccination efforts and increase public messaging, this isn't always what happens. There was, in fact, early information on an influenza outbreak solely from syndromic data, but it didn't result in health agencies actually beginning activities that could have had significant positive effect on controlling or at least lessening the impact of the outbreak.
Okay, so there is potential here. We just have to actually act on it. Is that what you're saying? Like how Harry and Ron had to decide to take the flying car to get to Hogwarts and Chamber of Secrets?
What? No, not at all. But hey, stop it with the Harry Potter references.
So when it comes to acting on syndromic surveillance information, it isn't just health officials we're talking about here, but policymakers too. The debaters seem to think that syndromic surveillance data alone would most likely not be adequate to inspire significant actions by policymakers. Instead, it may just be that in certain cases, this data can be a supplementary source of information that policymakers can use in making disease outbreak decisions.
But even if we are able to systematically define syndromic surveillance, gather enough information, weed through the information, and actually act on this information in a productive manner, there is still another barrier.
It's sort of hard to think how there can be even more barriers, but go on.
Well, even if we figure all of this stuff out, syndromic surveillance still needs thorough evaluation and analysis. This was, in fact, the major point of Dr. Reingold's paper.
Right. Okay, I guess we did mention this. I'm still just sorting through all of these snitches. I mean, information.
Ugh, why?
Come on, we're definitely funny.
Why do I feel like I'm the only one keeping us on track today?
Sorry, you're right. Okay, let's continue. So because of all these parameters and ifs and maybes and whatnot, the funding for syndromic surveillance is still a very controversial issue.
Again, depending on the definition and parameters one chooses to use for syndromic surveillance, it can either be really useful or just supplementary. Because of this, it's pretty difficult to agree upon how much money it should receive.
And any possible reallocation of support away from or to syndromic surveillance needs to be very carefully considered, especially in terms of how effective any alternative options could be in providing more useful and reliable information on outbreaks.
However, the debaters did overwhelmingly agree that there needs to be increased funding for laboratory capacity building in less wealthy nations, so that syndromic surveillance doesn't have to be the only option available to these regions.
So, taking all of this into consideration, the debaters seem to think that the best strategy is to use this method of surveillance in settings where a specific disease is targeted and where specific intervention activities are being considered. It definitely provides a good option when other data isn't available and where there isn't access to labs.
This being said, if laboratory testing and analysis is in fact available, this is still probably the best option for surveillance, and syndromic surveillance can just be used as a supplement.
Wait a second. I just realized that we haven't even covered who's running or funding all of this.
True. That's because that's also about as sticky an issue as Fluffy's drool.
Fluffy?
Come on, Fluffy, the three-headed dog who only goes to sleep if he hears music.
Another Harry Potter reference.
Why am I not surprised?
To be honest, you asked for that one. Anyway, the World Health Organization, or WHO, was definitely discussed a good amount during this debate, but determining its role in syndromic surveillance proved challenging.
In other words, the WHO's role in evaluating and funding surveillance still needs to be pinned down. It's possible that the WHO could have both advisory and coordinating roles to play in evaluation, but the organization's current structure may not even be appropriate to perform such tasks.
So I know we've given you a lot of information today.
And a lot of Harry Potter references.
But there are clearly still a lot of holes in this discussion and questions to be answered. And that's where you can step in to help.
That's right. Do you have a definition for syndromic surveillance? Other examples of it? Suggestions for how it could be funded, or if it should be funded at all?
Or maybe you have a question for us about something we mentioned today that can further this discussion. Whatever it is, be sure to let us know on Twitter.
Or if you're feeling ambitious and need more than 140 characters, write on our Facebook wall by searching ISGP's The Forum.
Also, I highly encourage you to join me in creating more analogies between Harry Potter and syndromic surveillance. Isn't it fun?
You can message Aubrey directly for those. Anyway, that's it for us today, though. So thanks for socializing with science. We'll catch you right here next time on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.